Support for this podcast comes from San Francisco International Airport. Some want it all. SFO wants zero. Zero landfill waste, net carbon, and net energy by 2030. Learn more about the triple zero goal at flysfo.com.
From KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Political Breakdown. I'm Scott Schaefer.
And I'm Marisa Lagos. Today on The Breakdown, she spent 22 years as a judge in Contra Costa County. Now, Dinah Becton is the county's first female and first African-American district attorney.
She is also, by the way, rumored to be on Governor Gavin Newsom's list to become the state's next attorney general, if and when Javier Becerra is confirmed to be health secretary in the Biden administration. She'll join us to talk about all of that and also what she's doing to achieve her goal of reducing mass incarceration in California. But first, Marisa, speaking of that guy, Javier Becerra, he had a couple hearings this week in the Senate, long awaited. He had one on the Health Committee, another one with the Finance Committee, and you know, for all the expectations and anticipation, it went fairly smoothly for him. It looks like while there were some tough questions on things like abortion, doesn't look like they're ready to die on that hill to stop his nomination.
It's funny, this was framed as a grilling, but I felt like it was not. I mean, were there tough questions on abortion? Essentially, you had people like Mitt Romney saying, well, we're just going to have to agree to disagree. I mean, what Republicans did sort of hammer on was this question of whether he is up to the job in the sense of his qualifications, right? Should they be putting a doctor in this position instead of an attorney? And, you know, one of the Democrats responded, well, out of the last six HHS secretaries, one was a doctor. And guess who that was? Tom Price. Had to resign in disgrace after being accused of misusing public resources and flying jets everywhere. So,
exactly. There's always a little bit of hypocrisy there when it comes to nominees. I think my favorite line, though, of the hearing was with Javier Becerra was being asked about contraception, that case where California sued the federal government over the Little Sisters of the Poor and access to abortions. And he said, I never sued any nuns. I'm sure that's never been said before in a confirmation hearing. But he wanted to point out, no, I sued the federal government. I didn't sue the nuns themselves.
Yeah, I mean, it does seem like as much as there is Republican opposition to this, he will probably get appointed and confirmed by the Senate, which, of course, leaves that seat open. Another appointment for Governor Newsom.
We may want to ask our guests about that in just a moment. Maybe. And of course, the recall and vaccines and COVID never too far from the scene, still top of mind for us. And NPR, in fact, this week had an investigation on One Medical, which is based here in San Francisco, alleging that they were giving vaccines to people who were ineligible to get them, some friends and family of some of the leadership of the company. And it just goes to show the sort of almost desperation some people feel, along with entitlement, I suppose, to try to get the vaccine as quickly as they can. It does seem like they're now, I mean, I personally know a lot of people, teachers and seniors and so on, who have gotten the vaccine. So it is finally getting out to people, but not before it has caused and, you know, continues to cause a lot of consternation. And, you know, people are just anxious to get that shot in their arm.
Understandably. I mean, I think, and that dovetails into the other kind of big conversation topic of the week in California politically, which is around school reopenings and the questions of teacher vaccines. And I mean, I really do think, you know, one thing you and I and our, you know, we've talked about internally as we think about covering these issues is like, this could all change so quickly, right? I mean, as more people get vaccinated, as more vaccines get distributed, Johnson & Johnson getting approved this week, you know, it does feel like so much of this stuff that is such a crisis kind of mode right now could really change, hopefully. I mean, fingers crossed, man. My kids are very loud and downstairs all day long, let me tell you. So I think that, you know, it feels like a pivotal moment. And of course, that's going to impact things like the recall and what things look like for someone like Governor Newsom.
It does. And I think, you know, for small businesses who are really suffering in some ways the most during this pandemic, people of color working on front lines in grocery stores, I mean, they can't get vaccinated soon enough. And, you know, the economy needs to recover. There's been, just looking around San Francisco, there's so many out of business signs and windows. It's really very sad. And, you know, in San Francisco next week, it looks like they're going to begin in restaurant dining again. And it, which makes me a little nervous. It's because, you know, there are these variants out there and everyone is not vaccinated. And a lot of these other things like school reopenings are kind of dependent on the rates being at a certain level. So I hope we don't look back in 3 weeks and say, why did we reopen too quickly?
Yeah, I am sort of baffled by that. I am. I mean, I don't get it. We all seem to agree, no matter what your political party or background, that like schools need to be open and that should be the first priority. And yet it's clearly not, it's still not the first priority. And I'm not just dinging the school board, which we could spend probably a lot of time doing here, but you know, like we are, I mean, I just think as a society, it shows that we don't always do a good job of kind of prioritizing the things that we say we need to.
Yeah. And you know, a Guy Marzorati, our producer here, actually did some reporting on the politics of all this and the teachers union and the pressure that school districts and superintendents and politicians are under. And, you know, in their defense, you know, there is a lot of conflicting information out there. As Guy reported, you know, you can ask parents, do you want your kids back to school? And they all say yes, but then they also say they're concerned, you know, about getting right. sick, or their parent, their kids getting sick, or the teachers getting sick. So, you know, if this were easy, it would have been done a long time ago.
Well, we saw that this week with the Republican candidates who hope to challenge Newsom either in a recall or in 22, who have been dinging him on all this. Kevin Faulkner, former San Diego mayor, businessman John Cox, also from San Diego. And when asked, well, then would you strip collective bargaining rights from teachers to get schools open? Both said, no, even as they're saying that he's too close to teachers. So, I mean, it is. And I think to your point and to that excellent story that Guy did, I really encourage people to check it out. There's no easy answers because this has been, a situation that has continued to progress. And also, you know, there's so many people are fearful. You hear about these long-timer symptoms. You hear about brain fog. I mean, the hospitals look better, but it's certainly not something, you know, we want to expose people to.
No, absolutely not. You certainly want to avoid it if you can. All right, we're going to take a short break. And when we come back, we're going to be joined by Contra Costa County's top law enforcement official, District Attorney Dinah Becton. You're listening to Political Breakdown from KQED Public Radio.
Support for KQED podcasts comes from Star One Credit Union, now offering real-time money movement with Instant Pay. Make transfers and payments instantly between financial institutions. Online or through Star One's mobile app. Star One Credit Union, in your best interest.
I'm Katia Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
And welcome back to Political Breakdown. I'm Scott Schaefer, here with Marisa Lagos. And our guest today is the top law enforcement official in Contra Costa County. Dinah Becton spent 22 years as a Superior Court judge in the county. And soon after she retired from the bench, she was picked to fill out the term of the county's previous DA, who had resigned amidst a scandal involving misuse of campaign funds. She was then elected to a full 4-year term as DA. Dinah Becton, welcome to Political Breakdown.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we're good. Glad to have you. So, as we said, you spent a long time on the bench, and I'm wondering, had you ever thought of being a prosecutor or a public official, for that matter, you know, in all that time?
Actually, that was about the furthest thing from my mind. I had a wonderful career, frankly. I'd had, before becoming a lawyer, I'd had an opportunity to work in finance. I worked in housing and community development for some time. And 22 years was, I had a wonderful career. I had amazing opportunities to serve the community in my time as a judge. As you know, I was elected as presiding judge. Mm-hmm. And that gave me a lot of experience as in terms of budgets and administration as well. And then I had great opportunities to, you know, for example, serve as State Bar Access and Fairness Chair, which was a huge part of my work, and President of the National Association of Women Judges, which again, oh, wow, was a significant part of my work. And so I'd had a wonderful time serving the public in that capacity. when the former district attorney resigned, my phone just started ringing, and people wanted to know if I could bring not only my experience administratively, but also a new lens to this thing about criminal prosecution. People had seen for so long all of the tough on crime approaches to criminal justice and came to understand that it wasn't necessarily keeping our community any safer. Mm-hmm. So people were literally calling for an opportunity to see something different and asked me if I would consider putting my name in, which I did. And obviously the rest is history. 12 candidates, and I was selected initially in 2017. I ran in a highly contested race in 20 and won in the primary in 2018. So I'm really pleased and proud to serve the people of Contra Costa County in this capacity.
Yeah, well, we want to get into some of the work you did, but first let's go back to the beginning of your life. You were raised in Oakland. I'm not sure if you were born in the Bay Area. Yeah. I'm just curious, what was your childhood like in Oakland at the time? What was the city, as you called it? I know you spent a lot of time also with your grandparents out in Hayward as well, right?
You know, I did. So yes, I'm a native Californian. I was born and raised in Oakland, East Oakland, Deep East, as it is now, I understand, called. And I'm a proud graduate of Castlemont High School. But growing up, I mean, I'm literally growing up in the 50s and 60s. And thank you for mentioning my grandparents. It's kind of interesting. My grandparents, of course, left the South and many of the problems that so many people had, the Jim Crow South. And my grandparents moved to a place called Russell City. As a small community right in the heart of Hayward. And so here we were. We lived in East Oakland in a home with our parents during the week. And we spent the weekends with my grandparents out in Russell City. It was like they still lived on the farm in the South, you know. they had a wood-burning stove. That was how we cooked. We drew water from a well. And,
Was the country.
Wow. The country.
And I had an outhouse and all of that. The cows, my grandmother was a beekeeper and everything from the land. And
wow.
So
cool.
That's how we lived on the city girls in the day, in the week, and country girls on the weekend.
And so. I think I read that your grandparents came from the South, from Louisiana. Is that right?
That's right.
What brought them here, and did you go back there with them at all?
Oh, of course, yes. You know, one of the things that's very prevalent in the life of a Black child is to go back home, you know, with your parents and with your grandparents. And so we did make some pilgrimages there. But certainly it was the harsh conditions of the South, and that is what led to the great migration of so many Black families in America to try to leave those places and seek out a better way for their families and their children.
And is that why you say your name, Dinah, not Diana?
Well, I don't know. If my dad were here, I wish clarification on that. I mean, all of my life, you know, my name is spelled, it looks like Diana, and but my dad named me Dinah. Huh. And so there we go.
All right. Yeah. I mean, obviously you're a lawyer. You end up going on to law school. Was there an expectation in your family that you would go on to higher education?
Well, I think my parents, who my grandparents did not graduate even from high school. But my parents, of course, did have at least a high school education, but they've always did encourage us to, you know, to go ahead and go forward, although they didn't really understand the systems or the resources or anything like that. They just knew that they wanted us to go to college. But really for me, I started out, I think, saying earlier, I'm a child of the 50s and the 60s, and there was so many things that were happening during that time. There were like, I don't know how many movements, you know, we had the civil rights movement, which was just major. We had the Black Power movement coming into the forefront. We had the Vietnam War going on and the women's rights and gay rights and all these things were going on. I can remember as a little girl watching little Ruby Bridges, you know, walk up to the school and through those angry crowds trying to integrate the schools. And I can remember when Rosa Parks refused to give up her seat on the bus. I know I'm dating myself, but these are the things that were going on. We watched the sit-ins and at lunch counters, and we couldn't help but as kids to wonder and to question, you know, why people were being treated so differently and why some lives seemed to be valued so much more than others. The other thing that I saw, though, during that time was how much legislation was driving change. And I knew that a lot of lawyers were legislators as well. And that's how I got my dream to want to be a lawyer. I'd never met any. I saw Perry Mason on TV. I just had that dream from the time I was a little girl, based on all of those circumstances, to want to try to effectuate change in my community.
And so you went to Golden Gate Law School, university, and then you graduated and you opened up your own law firm. What kind of law firm was it? What kind of practice?
Well, I started out, you know, I used to work for the city of Richmond. So I was supervisor of the Housing Finance and Development Division. And it is there that I went to law school at night. And so when I graduated from law school, I wasn't really sure I wanted to practice law necessarily. Had a career. I was really enjoyed what I was doing for the community at that time. But I decided to do some pro bono work, and that was very rewarding. I actually initially went to work with a lawyer out in the Point Richmond area, and we became partners and built our firm up. We had about 5 lawyers, I think, working for us in paralegals, primarily focusing on real estate and construction and housing and landlord-tenant law. We did some criminal work as well, criminal defense work. Okay. But those were the primary areas. And so when I struck out on my own, that was the same work that I carried with me.
That's great. And then you were actually appointed by Pete Wilson, a Republican, to the bench. How did that come about? Was that something you sought out? Like, I know there's often people kind of campaign to get on those lists. How did that come about?
It was a slow go for me. You know, one of my mentors and friends is recently appointed. Supreme Court Justice Martin Jenkins was one of my major mentors, but certainly seeing me in court around that time, he would always encourage me to put my name in to the governor's office for an appointment. And honestly, it took about maybe a year and a half of him sort of poking at me, and finally I completed that application and submitted it. I did receive word back that my application was simply dead on arrival because of my party affiliation. And so, you know, it was a slow go for me. Just really, like, people said to me, if you change your party, you can get an appointment. But I felt like I would be compromising something, because I felt like I am who I am. And if I'm worthy of an appointment, I should receive that.
So what turned it around? Because it went from DOA to on the bench.
DOA. I think what happened is I started getting a lot of support, both on both sides of the aisle. So both, if we're talking about parties, both Democrats, both Republicans, people really who knew me and knew of my work and my work ethic just really started going to bat for me. And I'm grateful for all of those folks who put the word in for me to say, hey, you ought to take a look at this one. So I was appointed originally in 1995, and I was appointed by, Governor Pete Wilson.
So we kind of mentioned at the top that you have come in and you know, as a DA, talked a lot about, you know, incarceration rates and changing the conversation and really where the rubber meets the road around criminal justice. Is that something that you... that kind of garnered on the bench? Did you oversee criminal trials where you were like, oh my gosh, I can't believe I'm handing down these sentences? Or like, how did your work as a judge inform where you stand now on criminal justice?
Yeah, it's probably so many of the things that you just mentioned. Having the opportunity to serve and serve in many different capacities. For example, in addition to, you know, working in civil, and I actually supervise that division, I worked with juvenile as well. And I had a chance to see young people who might move from one workload. Like, on one hand, one day I'm actually sitting as a judge that's protecting children from adults who might be trying to harm them. The next day, I am hearing cases about kids who are now in our criminal justice system are on their way. And so it was heartbreaking because you could see this pattern of people moving from one space to the other. And then when I started doing criminal trials, of course, and some of the same young people I would see there as adults. And so I knew that something was broken in our system when people were coming to us in that way. In addition to that, you start noticing that, especially as the laws really began to become tougher and tougher and longer sentencing, you began to realize that there really, you didn't have much say about what could happen in a case, no matter what you might thought would be the just outcome. You really didn't have much say about it because of the way the laws were written. And so it became clear that the prosecutor was really the person in the courtroom with the power. And that's because the prosecutor, you know, has so much decision-making, you know, deciding what to charge, who to charge, when to charge, plea bargaining, and all of that. Just a major player in that courtroom.
Also,
I just want to mention that even, you know, as a judge, I really wanted to make sure I was doing things, not only to open the pipeline for others, but also to do major things in the community. So we started doing, started partnering, especially with the faith community, to bring certain events to the community. We did the Know Your Rights so that young kids could know, you know, how to interact with law enforcement and also have an opportunity to sit down one-on-one and talk with people in law enforcement, and we could begin to shape and form a dialogue. And then I also came to understand how detrimental to people especially those who are reintegrating into society after serving time away, how detrimental it was to have criminal convictions on their records. And so I also brought those events as well to serve people who and bring knowledge to the community to let people know of how they could get their records cleared.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Political Breakdown. I'm Scott Schaefer here with Marisa Lagos, and we're talking today with the District Attorney of Contra Costa County, Dinah Becton. Well, let's fast forward a little bit to after the bench. You had retired, and you were then appointed by the county supervisors to become DA. What kind of reception did you get in the office from all these prosecutors, these lifelong prosecutors, to you, somebody who had never been one and who had, you know, different thoughts about criminal justice reform and sentencing and all that stuff?
Well, it was a bit chilly, let's just say. It was a challenge to walk into an office. I mean, my primary opponent was very popular and is very popular in the office. And so I think most everyone in the office had supported him in his push to become the next prosecutor. And I just frankly was not supposed to be there. That's basically, I think, the way it was viewed. So I think that's one of the reasons that, you know, my collaborative leadership style has served me well. And it speaks volumes, I think, to the fact that we've been able to get so much done in terms of pushing the needle towards change and towards a system that's fairer and just, more just, even in the midst of opposition.
I'm curious about the broader reception. We're seeing down in Los Angeles right now, former San Francisco DA, newly elected Los Angeles DA, George Gascón, getting pushback might be a kind term for this. His own deputies have sued him over some of his directives. The Statewide DA's Association, which I think you're still a part of, joined that lawsuit. I mean, what has your sense been when you're talking with the broader district attorney community? Have you felt embraced? Do you think that what we're seeing in LA is indicative of bigger fissions within those groups?
Well, I think what we see, you know, with George Gascón is he's doing, you know, what he told the people he would do. This is what he promised to do. And that is why the people elected him with a mandate of reform. And I think it's very clear right now that the majority of American people want criminal justice reform. He promised evidence-driven policies that are reflective of proven research. He promised that he would roll back all of the results of being tough on crime and the long sentences that have been imposed. And he's doing what the people have elected him to do. And so, yeah, I think it's unfortunate that we seem to have this, you know, riff where we've had the largest association of prosecutors in our state, you know, line up with aligned prosecutors. I think I really don't like the precedent that it has set, because really and truly, the people elect us to use our discretion. And I think when the prosecutor is doing what the people have asked him to do, you know, it is a very difficult type rope to be in, to have those within your office and within the larger community.
Yeah, I'm sure you have to kind of like watch your back. I'm wondering, you know, from the other side of the political spectrum, though, you know, thinking of Kamala Harris, she was the first Black, first female DA in San Francisco, then AG for the state. And she was under a lot of pressure from some of the liberal advocacy groups, you know, who saw her as, you know, one of them and expected her to embrace the things that they cared most about in terms of, you know, police reform and that sort of stuff. Have you felt that as well in your role as DA, sort of getting pressure from both sides, you know, the career prosecutors in the office, but also the community?
Well, yes, of course. And I think one of the things that's been important to me is to regularly meet. I mean, there is a thing in Contra Costa County called a community accountability table. And so as opposed to, you know, so and they're advocates, right? And their job is to push the envelope on all of the things that they think will move us closer into criminal justice reform. And so I appreciate those voices at the table. And I meet with them just as I meet with any other group in our community, to hear their voices, to hear their input, and to see there are many very good suggestions that we're able to implement. And so I think keeping an open door and understanding that everybody has a role to play in pushing change in our community.
So we just mentioned Kamala Harris. She obviously was Attorney General before U.S. Senator. Now Javier Becerra is going to probably be moving to Washington, D.C., and we have heard your name come up repeatedly on the short list for Attorney General. Is that a job you want? And what would you bring to it?
Well, right now, I will say that I have my hands full right here in Contra Costa County, so there's so much work that we started and that we're going to continue to do. But I do think that it is quite an honor to be considered consistently and to be on the list and to be considered by the governor. I support whatever decision the governor decides to make. I think what would be important is to bring a reform lens. And I think that there's just several things that I would hope that are of importance to selecting that next attorney general. One would be a person who, I think in this climate, you know, everybody is asking for a greater oversight of our police agencies, especially and about reducing racial profiling and excessive force and other behaviors that have, for a few, have undermined the credibility of a profession. And so we really would be looking for that as well. I think it would be important to support and provide resources to achieve greater transparency, you know, into police misconduct through SB 1421 and maybe other measures. And also robust transparency with respect to other things that are so important to prosecutors, like Brady obligations. And so those are the kinds of things that I think, and also willing to use the power of that office to support and push legislative changes that can be so very important to criminal justice reform as
Might
well.
Be a little further than some of the AGs in the past have gone, huh?
Yeah. Well, Diana Becton, thank you so much. Martinez isn't that far from Sacramento, right? I mean, it's just like a half
right
an hour
away.
Commute. Come on. Well, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
I appreciate you having me. Thank you.
And that does it for this edition of Political Breakdown, a production of KQED Public Radio.
Our producer is Guy Marzorati. Our engineer is Katie McMurrin. KQED's team includes Holly Kernan, Ethan Tobin, Lindsay, Vinnie Tong, Erica Aguilar, and Jonathan Blakely. We'd love to know who you'd like to hear on the show in the weeks ahead. You can tweet your suggestions to me. I'm at MLagos.
Or to me. I'm at Scott Schaefer. Send us some good ideas, and we'll take it from there. Thanks so much for listening. Stay safe out there.
Do you love your local bookstore? Well, I have the perfect event for you. This Saturday, April 27th, is Independent Bookstore Day. It's a day to celebrate your favorite local bookstore. I'm Olivia Allen Price, host of the Bay Curious podcast here at KQED, and I'm popping in to let you know that we will be hosting an event at Green Apple Books in San Francisco for the occasion. Come out for an author Q&A about the Bay Curious book. We'll be playing some Bay Area-themed trivia. There will be prizes and so much more. And the best part, tickets are donation-based, and all proceeds go to the Prisoners Literature Project. Learn more at kqed.org/live. I hope to see you there.